Welcome to the program. Good evening, America. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Before we get going, Lisa, let's do the disclaimer.
You didn't ask us how we were doing, Sam.
How are you doing, Lisa?
Doing good.
How you doing, Cliff?
How you doing, Lisa?
Doing well.
Okay, we just want to remind everyone that we're not attorneys and that a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for choosing to spend a little time with us this evening and tuning in.
We have an excellent program lined up for you this evening. We're going to talk a little bit about Selma. You know, we just had the 50th anniversary of the march in Selma. And going to compare Selma to some of the things that's going on in Ferguson and elsewhere in the nation. And we asked the question, has anything changed? So, you know, I think this would be a good opportunity for our listeners to call in or chime in, if you will, in the chat room. Again, our phone number is 347-838-8976. And joining us a little bit later in the program to talk about Selma is Cheyenne Webb Christberg. And she was once called Selma's smallest freedom fighter by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so I believe she was 8 years old at the time when the march happened in Selma, and she used to sneak out of the house to go and participate in meetings and that type of thing. So she's going to share some of her recollection of what happened in Selma at that time and then talk a little bit about the conditions and the situation in Selma now. And before we get to that, we have several things that we can talk about. One of the things that I know, Cliff, you wanted to talk about, a situation that recently occurred in Texas.
Yes, it's the, brings out the presidential Republican presidential hopeful, I guess you can call him, Rick Perry, who was the former governor of Texas. And this article is in The Guardian today, and it's entitled Rick Perry Executed an Innocent Dad After Prosecutor Hid Evidence in Kids' Arson Deaths. And that comes from the Texas Bar. That is the title of the article. And when I first saw the title, I thought, okay, well, that's a little bit harsh. They're blaming him for the execution, him being Rick Perry. Maybe it's just a spin on some of the facts or the fact that he was the governor. But when you get into the article, you see that he ensured that this execution went on. And it's a very sad situation. It's a sad case for, I mean, this man was innocent. The evidence pointed to it. And Rick Perry, you know, in my opinion, ensured that he got executed. In the read a few excerpts from the article. It starts out saying earlier this month, the bar, this is the Texas bar, lodged a petition in Navarro County near Dallas alleging that John Jackson, who was the prosecutor, withheld evidence that pointed to the innocence of Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed in 2004 for the murder of his three young daughters who died in a house fire in 91. Quote, before, during, and after the 1992 trial, Jackson, the prosecutor again, knew of the existence of evidence that tended to negate the guilt of Willingham and failed to disclose that evidence to defense counsel. And remember, this is a case where a man was executed. This man died. The prosecutor knew there was evidence to exonerate him. He hid that evidence. And says Jackson was the assistant district attorney at that time. Later, he became a judge there in Texas. And the complaint also claims that Jackson dishonestly told a court that he had no evidence that could help Willingham's defense. So this is not just something where, he implied that there wasn't evidence or he had something that he didn't give up. He told the judge, no, I don't have anything that can help this man's defense. I have no evidence pointing to that. This is Jackson has strongly maintained his innocence and insisted that Willingham, who was age 23 at the time of the deaths, was guilty of arson. And it says, however, Webb, who was a witness, who was, you know, he was basically paid off. He recanted, not, he was a jailhouse snitch. So Webb recanted his testimony in 2000 and gave interviews to the Marshall Project in 2014, in which he said he lied on the witness stand so that Jackson would help reduce his sentence and arrange thousands of dollars in help via a wealthy local rancher. Also key to Willingham's conviction was forensics evidence from arson investigators that was subsequently discredited by experts as being based on a misinterpretation. And this is a part that really got me when I read this article. It says that despite mounting concern that Willingham was innocent, the former Texas governor Rick Perry refused to stay his execution. In 2009, after an investigation by the Texas Forensic Science Commission found that the arson evidence was faulty, Perry replaced the board's chairman and two other members and called Willingham a monster. So he replaced the members of the wow. board who were basically saying, hey, this evidence is not correct. This man, you should stay this execution so we could, because the arson evidence is faulty. What we're looking at does not follow what the prosecutor is saying the evidence is. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas at that time, fired the chairman and two board members, basically saying this man is going to be executed. Then to top that off, when he was during one of his debates, back in 2012 for his presidential bid, Perry was asked whether the possibility of having executed an innocent person made it hard for him to sleep at night. His response was, no, sir, I've never struggled with that at all. This is after you fire the chairman and two board members of the commission that came to you and said, this man is innocent. The evidence that you guys are relying on is flawed. But you explicitly, no, sir, I've never struggled with that at all. I had this man killed, and I don't have any problem with that. And then it says, in 2013, another former Texas prosecutor, Ken Anderson, was sentenced to, this is the guy who was sentenced to 10 days in jail, 500 hours of community service. His community service was probably spending time at home with his kids. As part of a plea deal related to evidence withheld in the erroneous conviction of Michael Morton, who spent nearly 25 years behind bars for a murder that he didn't commit. And I believe we either had Michael Morton or had him on the show before. But then you look at all these things that happened, that Rick Perry played a part and ensure Willingham was executed, that this prosecutor Jackson, he withheld evidence and paid off a snitch and all these things. Then it says, if found guilty, the prosecutor Jackson could be disbarred, but he retired in 2012. So nothing happens to him. This is not just a person spending time in prison. That's bad enough. This is a man who was executed. So in my opinion, Jackson, the prosecutor, and Rick Perry are basically guilty of murdering this man. Because how do you set up a commission to do an investigation to say, tell me what's going on because they're saying something is wrong with the evidence? The commission comes back and says, we found that the evidence you guys are relying on is faulty. Well, you know what? I'm getting rid of all of you guys who says that it's faulty because this man needs to die. He's a monster. The evidence says he's not a monster. He did not commit any crime. You say he's going to die anyway.
Well, the responsibility lies with the not only the governor. I mean, Rick Perry is responsible because, and the statistics, I don't know if anyone's ever done it, the statistics on stays that actually granted in a situation of death penalty cases are so rare that people don't even know how to react to that. But I think it goes back to what we talked about the other night. There was a court that ignored evidence. The appellate court ignored it. The Supreme Court for the state of Texas ignored it. By the time it gets to the governor's feet, every person in the process of this judicial process in the state of Texas failed.
Right.
And that is the tragedy of it. You have a compound effect of nobody caring and everybody sticking to their guns regardless of what's right and what's wrong. And that is the problem with our judicial system today.
That's right. And even, I mean, with all that, I mean, yeah, absolutely, the whole system failed Mr. Willingham from the prosecutor, from the time he was arrested all the way up. But then the governor, I mean, to do a stay is not saying, yes, this man is innocent and he's not guilty of the crime. To do a stay because a commission that was appointed to double check the evidence, to double check the investigation. This commission comes back and says, hey, Governor, you need to stay this execution because there's something here that does not look right. This man is not guilty. The evidence is flawed. And the governor fires them, says, you know what? Yeah, I impaneled this commission. So guess what? You're fired because this man is going to be lethally injected. We are going to kill him. It's not difficult to do a stay.
I mean, you can at least to look into.
Right. The government can say, okay, we're going to stay his execution for a week. I'm going to give you a week to bring me solid, even more solid information. I mean, they gave him solid information. He chose to ignore it and say, just to make sure you don't bring me any more solid information, I'm going to fire you. So don't come back to me saying this man is innocent. He is going to die regardless because I, as the governor, believe that he's guilty no matter what the evidence says.
And, you know, Cliff, the Marshall Project reported that the punishment could range – the punishment for Jackson could range anywhere from no discipline to disbarment. And like you said, he's retired. So, wow, that's really going to hurt him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but the bottom line is he probably won't be disbarred because especially once the prosecutor – they're immune already. They get this blanket immunity. But then, especially after they retire, then it's like, okay, well, he's not really in the system anymore as a state or federal, as basically a taxpayer employee. But he can go off and do his own thing. Even if he is disbarred, he can still say, hey, okay, well, I can do some speaking engagements and charge, you know, $25,000 for an hour for 100 people to come listen to me speak. This man needs to be in prison. He paid off a snitch to give a false testimony. He hid evidence that he knew was there. They said before, during, and after the trial, he knew of the existence of evidence that negated the guilt of Willingham.
That kind of thing is going to continue to happen until they start locking these men up who are doing this. These men and women who are crooked and corrupt, who are hiding evidence and making sure that people go to prison or people get killed when they've done nothing wrong. It's going to continue to happen until the system changes, until the process changes, until they start making them responsible for their own actions, and they have no responsibility at this point.
Well, the problem you have, I think, that is bigger than that, that goes even beyond that. You know, the point of immunity has been abused completely. These are things that they were not talking about when they set out initially that, hey, we don't want people going after prosecutors where
right.
they're nervous to
right.
do their job. That's a general statement.
And that's understandable.
But that is so far, and here's what does not make any sense to me whatsoever, is the fact that it is proven statistically now that it's not about that.
No,
it is an
not at all.
The situation has been abused beyond comprehension. It's been abused. So, you know, you have certain things where legislators will go back. Say if there's a law that's in place and the legislators come back and say, you know what, people are abusing this particular law. We need to go back and we need to change this.
Right. It needs an amendment.
It needs an amendment. We've amended this particular law because people have abused it. You're dealing with the same situation here. At a very high scale, statistically, the prosecutional misconduct across this country is at such a level, this needs to be amended now. That, you know what, and I think, Cliff, you made a good point the other night. You made the point that, you know what, you can have it where they're going to be at least threatened to be brought up on charges mm-hmm. for criminal behavior. If they should have the same situation that we would have as citizens, that if we go into a court, there's a preliminary hearing done on it, and say, look, we have sufficient evidence that this prosecutor has broken the law.
Exactly.
Like the gentleman in New York that has done the stuff he's done. If he went before court, the evidence is overwhelming that he has abused his office. And I think some type of relook at that system needs to be looked at.
Right, and see, that's the thing. The blanket immunity is not a law that was put into place by Congress. So this isn't something that was voted on by
sure.
the people. It's not a law. This is basically a decree by the courts and by the prosecutors that we will not be held responsible for what we do during our course of work. So you basically put it in place that I am going to be above the law as long as I call myself, quote unquote, working. You can say you're in any situation and working. Well, I was working on this case while I was at home, and then I went out to this nightclub. I shot this guy.
But I was in the capacity of my job.
I was looking for a witness. Yes, I was drunk. I drunk a fifth of Jack Daniels. I cracked somebody over the head with a bottle, and then I shot him because he was attacking.
And when do we decree anything? That sounds like a dictatorship.
That is a dictatorship.
That's a decree.
And yeah. I got two additional comments and just kind of reflecting upon a couple of things that we've talked about on this subject on A Just Cause Coast to Coast before. And that is the study that was done by Professor Samuel Gross from the University of Michigan, where, you know, his study, and this came out what around the August-September timeframe, that said that, you know, the U.S. has about 4% of defendants sentenced to die are innocent. And so when they looked back at all the cases over the years, and you calculate that at least 4%, and they said that that number is actually pretty conservative, but 4% of people on death row are sentenced to die, and that they have actually put people to death who were innocent. And this is an excellent example. You know, the other thing on this, too, is that so this retired judge, Judge Jackson, formerly a prosecutor in Texas, so he's retired. So I don't know what the stipulations are as far as his retirement pay if he gets disbarred. But if he gets disbarred, generally that doesn't mean he can't practice any longer, right?
He can't practice.
Well, I'm looking at the retirement benefits for judicial officers in Texas. And Texas published a document called Retirement Benefits for Judicial Officers, JRS Plan. And based on this, depending upon the length of service that they were in office, and then or on the bench, and then contributions to retirement plans and all that type of thing, this judge could make anywhere from $4,666 a month upwards to $10,499 a month. So basically, you're looking at anywhere from $4,600 upwards to $10,500. Now, you look at that, and let's say he's on the upper end of this.
Right.
So he's into six figures.
Yes.
He was partly responsible for an innocent man being executed, and he's fighting the process as far as being brought up on charges.
Right.
And if he is brought up on charges, the only consequences he may suffer is no discipline.
Right.
Disbarred.
Right. And the thing is, he's not going to get any discipline because he's retired.
Exactly.
If the state of Texas chooses to disbar him, then, you know, that's another thing. But he's retired.
So disbarred.
And basically, he's pretty much got the governor as his partner because, you know, if they find him guilty of something, then they'd have to find former Governor Rick Perry guilty of the same thing of having this man killed for nothing. And basically what he wants to do is to get a statute of limitations on them even doing
anything.
Type of investigation.
Yeah.
Because if he can keep this quiet for a while, then the statute of limitations come up and of course Rick Perry's gonna continue to fight against the Bar Association doing anything to him. It's just it goes back to what Lamont was talking about. The whole culture of the entire judicial system, and it goes from a local community culture of, like, you know, your district law enforcement all the way up to the federal level. And you look at this on a state the size of Texas, which, you know, is the size of some small countries, that here you have the governor and a prosecutor. The man is allowed to retire. That is what is so sickening and so unbelievable, because a man died. Not only did his kids die, and you don't know if someone else really
the real perpetrator.
Right, the real perpetrator. But the commission said the arson evidence is flawed. What they're saying is this was not arson. There was a fire, yes, where his children died, but he did not commit arson.
Yeah.
And so he's grieving over his children. His children are gone. Now he's dead, and they said the only statement that he said is, the only statement I want to make when he was about to be injected is that I am an innocent man, convicted of a crime I did not commit. I've been persecuted for 12 years for something I did not do. That on top of the grief of his three daughters being killed in a fire.
So you take this situation now, and you have this judge in Texas, again, former prosecutor, who was responsible for the execution of Willingham. So Judge Jackson, he gets the benefit of enjoying his retirement, enjoying his retirement pay, has enjoyed his family and all the things that come along with that. So let's shift just a little bit. Now you look at another case of Reginald Adams, who was wrongfully convicted of murder and cleared for state compensation. And they're offering him, or he gets $250,000 spread over a 10-year period. So here you have a man. How many years was he in prison?
34.
He spent 34 years in prison, 34 years of his life gone.
Over half of his life he spent in prison.
So you have a judge and a governor on the one hand who get to enjoy the benefits of life. You have another man who 34 years of his life taken away from him wrongfully. And you got a judge who can make six figures, potentially make six figures in retirement pay. And then on the other side.
And that's per year.
Exactly.
Six figures per
year. Per year.
Reginald Adams.
Just above the poverty line.
Right. He gets almost $25,000 a year.
And they're probably going to take taxes out of it.
Oh, they're going to take taxes out of it.
Here's what doesn't make sense to me. If he's disbarred and he is retired, he has no need to. He's not practicing law.
That is exactly the point.
So
what is the disbarment do? If he's making six figures a year plus whatever else he gets and whatever investment he did while he was a state employee, he's getting all this monetary value on top of the fact that he ensured that a man was died. When you have the Bar Association is saying he knew before, during, and after the trial that there was evidence that exonerated this man, and yet he pushed to get him killed, how do they even say that we need to do an investigation? This man should be arrested, and he should be executed, as far as I'm concerned, by legal manners. Right. But that's not going to bring Mr. Willingham back. I'm not about the death penalty. But he needs to be... He needs to be locked up in prison.
Well, the problem is, and this is what is so bizarre about the system, this is not something that's coincidental or accidental here. They are aware this man is retired. So for you to, but they prey on the ignorance of people that don't understand. So, well, he got disbarred, though, and that's, we're grateful for justice. How old is this man? Is the question. I mean, is this guy old enough to be retired? And if I have no intention of practicing law any further, that is absolutely no consequence to me whatsoever that you've disbarred me. I've already done my work. I'm done.
Yeah, you're done with that. And then you have, on the other side of that, you have this man who he may get disbarred, but until he does, he can make up to $120,000 a year. And then you have someone who is exonerated after being wrongfully convicted for 34 years, but it's been in prison. He has not only been let out, but they declared him factually innocent.
Okay, let me ask you a question. If he's disbarred, what's the proof that he's going to lose his retirement?
That's what we were saying.
Right, he won't lose retirement from being disbarred. He's only lose retirement if the state says, because you were disbarred, we're going to take your
money.
Retirement. But then he'll fight that on appeal.
So that can be telehealth in court until he leaves
this
planet.
Until he dies.
Yeah.
Which hopefully is soon.
This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. Joining us in just a few minutes is Cheyenne Webb Christberg, and she's going to share some of her thoughts on Selma with the... 50th anniversary of the march in Selma just passed. She was a young 8-year-old when that happened. Coming up before the break, we have a clip from the Reverend Frederick D. Reese, who was also in Selma at that time. And so we're going to hear some words from Reverend Reese. And then also we got other things to talk about as far as some of the unrest that's going on and the injustice, the racism, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure you guys heard about the hanging in Mississippi. You know, there's a lot of speculation as to where what brought that about and what are the underlying currents in that. So we got a lot of things to talk about.
It was a black man that was hanged?
Oh, in Mississippi.
Well, then they'll say it was suicide.
Yeah. Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. Be right back.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure. We will be sure. Oh, glory.
Well, I became involved in the movement here in Selma. Then I signed the official invitation inviting SCLC and Dr. King to come to Selma. And so we encountered many acts of discrimination and even violence, because there were those of us who received physical harm. And so it was a great challenge. And we were determined that we were going to meet whatever the challenge was. We came to the Edmund Pettus Bridge here. And getting to the apex of that bridge, we saw on the other side Jim Clark. And then we were told we would not be allowed to continue that march. We were asked to turn around and go back to our home. And so Jim Clark gave the advice to to move in on us, but the billy club crushed on both ends. Went down the line of marches, beating heads, pushing us down to the ground. But we did not let that stop us. And we waited until we had received official notice from the president to continue that march. You think in terms of Selma to Montgomery, we're talking about 50 miles an hour. In fact, as we marched down Highway 80, so to speak, on the way to Montgomery, there were citizens cheering us on because they felt that particular call, called Just Cause, it had white and yellow skin color people, and all persons who had come to actually assist in this quest for the right for all people. And so all the way from Selma to Montgomery, we had persons. Some had water, some had food to give the marchers as we marched from Selma to Montgomery. And they helped us, gave us physical renewal, mental strength to keep going forward. And so we were successful in marching and then receiving hero's welcome as we enter the city, saying that we have been with you. And there were those who said, we have been praying for you. It was a feeling of great triumph and victory. We are in Montgomery.
Oh,
news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Just before the break, we heard a or during that break, we heard a tribute from 50th anniversary Selma tribute from Reverend Frederick D. Reese. And so we're going to talk a little bit about Selma 50 years ago and whether or not anything has changed and whether or not anything has changed over the last 50 years. I think before we go to our special guest, we have a special guest, Cheyenne Webb Kreisberg, and then we have a comment. Go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, we have a caller on the line. Walter, you want to make a question or you have a comment? Okay, I think Walter's having some technical difficulties.
Okay, so let's go on to our guest, Cheyenne Webb Kreisberg. She was 8 years old when the situation occurred in Selma, and she was called by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. the smallest freedom fighter. So welcome to the program, Ms. Kreisberg. How are you doing?
Thank you so very much.
So we understand that you might be a little hoarse, a little under the weather, so we certainly appreciate you taking time to join us. So, Ms. Kreisberg, as far as, you know, your experience in Selma 50 years ago, that must have been something monumental for an eight-year-old girl.
Well, certainly it was a very, very significant time and moment in my life as that eight-year-old child that I never thought would become a part of history in any way. And as I reflect on 1965 growing up and George Washington Carver Project from a poor family of eight, you know, it was rough. I could remember vividly as that child witnessing and experiencing racial discrimination, segregation, injustices, inequality, violence, and tears and death of people that I had the opportunity to meet as that little girl, people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who had a profound impact on my life after having met him. Viola Luso, a young woman who came to join in that struggle that I had an opportunity to meet and have a very intimate relationship with. As a matter of fact, she stayed in my best friend's home next door and many homes in GWC Project. Jonathan Daniels, who was the minister that was shot and killed, Reverend James Reeves, who lived in my home. So I have vivid moments that I would never, ever forget. And I'm just grateful that I had an opportunity to have met such unsung heroes, and more than anyone, Dr. Martin Luther King, who really inspired me and motivated me in a very special way after meeting him, that I became a very disobedient child to my parents. And you know, many will ask, well, how could you be so young, you know, participating and even understanding what was going on and what was that movement was all about? Well, with what I saw and experienced as that little child, being in the midst of those courageous freedom fighters who came to join in that struggle, it would strike a chord with any child at any given age. And I am just so glad to have been a part of that movement for change, and I feel grateful to have made the choices that I did, because it became very clear to me why I made a decision to do what I believed in, which was right, that my parents, who couldn't do it, who was very afraid, like so many other African Americans. So you couldn't be in the midst of that crowd of courageous foot soldiers and people who had come to join that movement without feeling that fervent faith, that embedded spirit that existed in the hearts and souls of everybody who was there to come to Selma, Alabama, in an effort for African Americans to gain their right to vote and to have the equal rights in which they deserve.
That's excellent. Ms. Kreisberg, this is Cliff Stewart. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight. A question for you is, based off what you saw in Selma 50 years ago, what do you think, how would you compare to what you see as far as civil rights today? What do you see? You spent a lot of time with Martin Luther King Jr. What do you see in our so-called civil rights leaders today that you would compare to his spirit, to his drive, to for civil rights? And then, can you answer for me, who is it that is leading the fight for civil rights for the African American community today?
Well, first and foremost, the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was one that is very hard to compare with any leader that I've ever had the opportunity of to be surrounded by. Even as that little girl, this man was so special, and he had such a way with people, leadership quality, that people would want to follow him. And I think with his leadership and the spirit in which he provided his leadership, that was exuberated in all of the people that he was surrounded by and the people that he spoke to, just to listen to him speak and talk about all of the problems, the challenges that we were facing that needed to be changed. It would gravitate your heart and your soul and your mind. And then the other thing, his philosophy of nonviolence was very critical. Every protest, every march that took place, Dr. King made sure that those marches and those protests were done with dignity, integrity, and peaceful. And everybody was on the same page. Initially, when Dr. King came to Selma, there was perhaps some, and he was the leader that brought things together and brought people together. And the difference between 50 years ago and presently that I see now very vividly is that there has to be one agenda that everybody, where everybody can be on the same page,
right,
fighting for the same cause. And we must come together, all people. There were a lot of people who came from all religious backgrounds, all colors. And that's what we need today. But what I'm seeing today in 50 years later in terms of leadership is that there are, when people constantly ask the question, well, who is our leader today?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that question can't quite be answered. And that's the line that's really drawn very, very large between the leadership of Dr. King in 1965 based upon the leadership today, because we have different leaders that different people follow. But I'm looking forward to the new movement, which is our young generation. And that's why I became a youth advocate. It made me feel very encouraged, very happy to see thousands of young people come to Selma for the 50th commemorative anniversary to not experience what happened, but also to generate greater interest and appreciation and the history that has given them the opportunity to step up and make a difference, and to also realize that right now is their time and they really matter in this process of change, because we're still facing many of the challenges that we did 50 years ago today. And I truly believe that it's going to be our young people who are going to embrace the somewhat of the same leadership that Dr. King had when he was our leader and led us to those changes that were made. And I am certainly hopeful for those changes to come that we all been waiting for, and that's why I'm going to continue to work with young people to not only continue to educate them, to get them to understand what it means to unify, become mobilized, to organize, and have a strong sense of determination with a strong commitment in order to make the changes that need to happen.
Yeah.
As we look at the situation in Ferguson and in other places across this country.
Absolutely. And Ms. Kreisberg, this is Lamont Banks. And again, appreciate the, you know, what you've seen and the knowledge that you can help us understand that time. And I think I echo something that you said earlier moments ago in regards to, if you have to ask the question, where is our leader, and it can't be answered, it is because there is no leader. And I think your point to the folks not having the same agenda, that is a difference today, because everybody's got a different motive. A lot of the civil rights, so-called civil rights leaders that at least are claiming the name or wearing the name of civil rights leaders are involved, whether it's politics, whether it's, you know, how can I write my next book? How can I be seen? Let me get the next big story and pop up on the news so I can be seen. Again, the agenda and the motivation is vast differently just from what I've learned in history of what the motivations of people were. And I think your point to that is very well made. What do you think going forward, as we sit here and try to analyze what's happening? I think the point that you made, that the next generation will step up, because this current generation, we seem to be in a bad situation. Our thoughts are is that what we've seen happen in New York City with African Americans being killed, cop shooting, to me, I was on an airplane. I shared this story some weeks ago, and a young lady sat next to me, and she said she cannot distinguish if it's the 1960s right now or if it's 2015. Would you agree with that assessment?
I sure will. I submit to you that since, the 1960s, that we have progress socially, politically, and somewhat economically, but we still have a long, long way to go. People are still suffering. People are still not being deprived of good education. There's a definitive need for jobs. Racism is still at an all-time high.
Yes.
Today, not only in southern states, but we see all over the United States,
yes,
people are being robbed of their identity and self-respect as human beings. And, our young people have become involved in many of these protests in Ferguson, and not necessarily being involved in the most positive way, but their concern that they have had with the Michael Brown case and the Eric Garner case, it has raised their consciousness in a sense that they want to see something done about it. But what we need to embrace is getting with our young people to have dialogues with them, to teach them how to have peaceful protest, how to come together and really be on the same page, and to be doing things in a sense where there's no other ulterior motives but to be there for that clear call. And and there's a definitive need for us to do this, not just to be do this when something comes up, but we got to be proactive right now and start working with our young people, with dialoguing with them, and even with them facilitating dialogue so that they can have a greater appreciation and leadership development in this process of being groomed to become those leaders. And that is so important that they know, they got to know that they matter in this process for change. Because I see everywhere that I go, I'm asked questions by young people, and I get the opportunity to speak to young people across this country. And it seems to me with what they're seeing on TV and what they're seeing in their communities based upon the politics, based upon versus the problems that are existing in their communities that's impacting their lives as well as others, they want to do something now. And many of the young people who walked across that bridge, if nothing else, they felt something very deep down in their soul that they wanted to take back from wherever they came. And the first thing is they want to get out there and get people registered to vote, especially young people of their ages. Even though we've elected our first African American president, still have so many young people and even some older people who are not exercising it because they have really become somewhat apathetic in the sense of thinking that vote is not going to matter because they're not seeing anything really happen different to move us forward because everybody are on different pages, everybody on their own agendas for whatever reason. And there's a definitive need now for us to have that youth movement so that everybody can be on the same page and understand what it is that they need to be working towards to move us forward and Ms. to make our communities, the beloved community that Dr. King and so many others sacrificed and gave up their lives for.
Ms. Kreisberg, this is Sam Thurman again. We know you're short on time, so we'll make this the last question. But do you still, or two-part question, do you still reside in Selma now?
Actually, I'm in Selma because that's where my dad still lives, and I'm between Selma and Montgomery. But actually, I'm all over the state of Alabama working with our young people.
Okay.
Speaking to young people across the country.
The reason I ask that is because earlier this week, the New York Daily News came out with an article that basically, you know, painted a picture that there was a condition or situation in Selma 50 years ago, and now 50 years later, that poverty levels, segregation, unemployment, and those type of situations still exist in Selma. And from the article's perspective, it's as if 50 years ago there was a march that occurred, made history. 50 years later, there's an anniversary. 70,000 people come to celebrate that anniversary. Those 70,000 people leave, yet poverty and violence and that type of thing still exists in this city. How would you reflect on the condition of Selma today, 50 years later?
Well, I too agree with that in a big way, simply because poverty still exists in Selma. Many of our young people are still being deprived of a good education in Selma, Alabama. There aren't many job opportunities. Our young people, there's much black-on-black crime there. It's a lot to be desired, and that's why it is necessary. It is so necessary for us and for the citizens of Selma and even those citizens who have come to witness this, because every report, every news reporter basically interview that I did, there were some concerns about the same thing that you're asking me. And it's for real. And that is the sad part about it. But I think that as a result of the thousands of people who have come to Selma to witness this, I think a change is coming. And I think there's much hope for people to join forces in making those changes in Selma, Alabama, with hope to leave Selma.
Did we lose her? Okay, well, joining us this evening, and we appreciate her joining us, that was Ms. Cheyenne Webb Kreisberg, and she was known and named by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as the smallest freedom fighter in Selma, and at the age of 8 years old, she got involved in the struggles there in Selma and participated in the march at the Eben Pettus Bridge. She is now a voice for justice, equality, and speaks around the state of Alabama and trying to, as she was saying, trying to encourage young people to get involved and to bring about change. We have another clip that we're going to bring during this next break, and I believe it is former President Bill Clinton, and he is recognizing the anniversary at Selma as well. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. When we come back, we're going to draw a couple more comparisons to some of the things that are going on today with regard to our justice system, the inequality, the injustice that's going on, and some of the other situations that are occurring. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Fifty years ago, starting from a small church in Selma, Alabama, a group of 600 men, women, and young people set off on a journey that, with its terrible and violent interruption on Bloody Sunday, has echoed ever since as one of the most profound appeals to the founding principles and enduring conscience of our nation. Five decades later, the journey those marchers started from Selma over the Edmund Pettus Bridge and on to Montgomery, it's come to symbolize more than ever our whole democracy's path toward a more perfect union. As a young man growing up in the South, I saw firsthand the degrading consequences of segregation and discrimination, and how poll taxes made a mockery of our most fundamental right. The civil rights movement, including the Montgomery bus boycott, the March on Washington, and the Selma marches, was one long journey to right those wrongs, and one that too often was met with violence. It's a journey we're still on today, as we can see from troubles all over the country. It's a journey toward more inclusive politics, where we work to make it easier for everyone to vote, not harder. And where, once the voting is done, we work together toward a more inclusive and less unequal economics, where everyone's abilities and drive are matched by an equal opportunity to succeed. And it's a journey toward a more inclusive society, where we widen the definition of us and narrow the definition of them, where our many interesting differences make life more enjoyable and progress more possible, because we know our common humanity matters more. Speaking in Montgomery after the third victorious march, Dr. Martin Luther King said, "Our feet are tired, but our souls are resting."
But our souls are resting.
Many of those who marched 50 years ago are thankfully still with us, including my friends, Congressman John Lewis and Hank and Rose Sanders. Many others have gone to their well-earned rest. It is up to all of us now who remain to take up the work and face the challenges that remain. The marchers at Selma 50 years ago showed us the way. Their courage, their grace, the force of their convictions will always serve as our example. We must not let anyone turn us around. God bless you all.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Cliff, let's go to the phones.
Yes, we have the truth on the line. You have a comment. You are live.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was thinking, as the lady that was just on, I can't remember her name, and was talking about the leadership, and I thought how important it is to have solid, strong leadership. And reason being that people don't do well. They're like sheep that just kind of scatter everywhere unless they have leadership. So it's so important to have leadership in this hour. But I think the greatest problem that we have, nobody is willing to die for it. Martin Luther King Jr. knew it was going to cost him his life. And with full knowledge of this, he continued to pursue justice, and not only for blacks, but for minorities all over this country, and with the full knowledge that he would die. And so I think that we've got people now that once marched with him are not willing to die for the cause. And I think it was Martin Luther King, I'm not sure, but I think it was Martin Luther King said, unless it's something that you're willing to die for, then it's not worth fighting for. So we really got to pull together. I have never heard of so many blacks being shot. Today, the man in Mississippi hung on a tree. It seemed like instead of it getting better, it's getting worse. And the fact is, the people who have influence in this country, who have money and power, because money is power, their voices are silent. I remember Oprah Winfrey not long ago coming out saying she hadn't said anything about anything because she's waiting for leadership. I thought, what's wrong with you? You're a well-known person. You have lots of influence and lots of money. So why are you waiting for leadership? We don't need you to play a part in Selma. We need you to deal with the real Selma that's still existing today. She'll play in a slavery movie and go out and what have you. She played in the movie called Selma. But we don't need actors. We don't need actresses. We need real people who say, you know, I don't have to play what happened 50 years ago because we're still dealing with that today. So why am I just willing to play in a movie? Why am I not willing to get out there and really put everything in? There are a lot of black people in this country that's in position, that have influence and power to make a difference, to join together, just them alone. If they're afraid to do it by themselves, just that group alone. If they would bind together and say enough is enough, we would see a drastic change in this country. When you see a black college student bloody face on a camera, and then you see or hear about this man that's hanging in a tree in Mississippi. What it's really saying to us, all that you're doing, it doesn't really matter. We're going to continue.
That's right.
And unless we get enough people who are willing to die for the cause, we're never going to have freedom. Not real freedom. There's freedom in God that we get as Christians. But I'm talking about freedom in this country as a human being and our human rights being violated every day. It's because these people stand back. And so she just uses the excuse, Oprah Winfrey does, I'm just waiting for leadership. Well, you done led in all these other things. Why didn't you say, hey, I'm going to have to take off all the glory and all these things and lay down my crown for a while and get out here and make a difference and make my voice heard? And how many other people would follow her if she would do it? And many other of these actresses and actors, you don't have to act this out. This is real life. I mean, what we're suffering in this country, every day I get up, I think, oh, who else is going to be dead today? It just shocks you. Who else is going to be shot? What are the parents? This mentally retarded man being shot. It's like it's all our war against Black America. And it's because the people who have the money and the power to make a difference is not doing anything about it. I mean, Martin Luther King never stopped. That man was so tired when he got ready to go to Memphis where they killed him at. From what you can read and hear about, he was so exhausted. But he said, I gotta go. I gotta go. This man had what they call fire in his belly. Nothing would stop this man. He wanted to go. That's why they got rid of him. But you know, if you get enough Martin Luther King Jr.'s with fire in your belly out there fighting, hey, you can't kill us all. You may knock on some of us, but you won't get all of us. But nobody's willing to die for the cause. And you know, the terrorists, they are on the rise everywhere. They're in this country. Our own citizens are turning against this country and joining a radical group like ISIS. These are murderers, and it's unbelievable. And they have done so much damage because they're willing to die for their cause. And it's an evil cause. Well, if they're willing to die for an evil cause, how much more should we as Americans, as African Americans in this country, and minorities get together and say, if they're making progress doing wrong, how much progress can we make doing right? They kill people. They show up anywhere at any time. And we wonder, oh, my God, they're spreading everywhere. We as a people can make a difference. But we got to have solid, strong leadership that says, keep going. Don't stop. Give it everything you got. Throughout Scripture, you will find there were strong leaders. There never was a time that God's people wasn't led by a prophet or somebody, the apostles leading. Somebody was leading. People have to have a shepherd. They have to have a leader that tells them, you can do it. Don't give up. That's why they made it through Selma. That's why our late President Johnson could sign the Civil Rights Voting bill. That's why he could do it, because they wouldn't give up. That's why we can sit at any counter we want to and eat, and we can live what we want to live and drive what you want to drive and all these things, simply because somebody kept fighting. But they're just killing black people left and right. I almost hate to turn my TV on in the morning because it's almost like, who else is dead? It makes you think, how much worse is it going to get before the people who have influence and power in this country that are African Americans stand up and say, wait a minute. It's time out. It's time out of our men being put in prison. It's the same mentality. The same thing. These are masters that are ruling our men in prison and put them behind brick walls and razor lines, wire fences, and they're going to prison without even a chance to prove they're innocent. Somebody's got to say, where does it stop? And who really cares about it? And I'm telling you, if we could get enough people to say we're willing to die for the cause, as they did coming across that Selma, across that bridge in Selma, and going to prison, being beaten with billy clubs and kicked and horses running over them. And these people didn't care. We wouldn't be where we are today if those people said, I don't care what you do to me. We're going to fight. We have a right to vote. Until our late President Lyndon Johnson was on TV saying, this is wrong. He didn't just say this is wrong and do nothing. He did something about it. He passed a bill to say we all as Americans have a right to vote. And what's wrong with us voting? What are you afraid of? I'm telling you, it makes me sad in my heart. Because it's like, who's going to be the next one? It could be your father, your mother, your sister, your brother. It could be your friend, somebody you know, who's hanging in a tree, who's shot in the face. Such a nice-looking young man being beaten on the ground when he turned over. And then I heard one of the reporters say today, well, flesh wounds, they bleed like that, like it's not a big deal. Don't read anything into this that it's really not. You know, when you get a flesh wound, a head wound, you're going to get more blood. I don't want to see anybody's blood for any reason. And we better raise our voices. At some point, we better stop. It's going to come a time in this country. If people don't rise up for the cause and be willing to die for it, I'm telling you, there won't be a cause, because more and more they are abusing the black people of this country. It is so sad. No respect. They're treated like the outcasts of our society. In many ways, they are. God help us and help this country, that we will say enough is enough. At some point, we've got to make it known. We're not going to let you kill another one of us. We're not going to have our sons hanging from trees. We're not going to have them beaten and choked to death on the street. Enough is enough. I heard a congressman say on TV when a reporter asked him, he said, how did you feel when you saw Mr. Garner being choked to death? He said, any human being in this country, if you didn't feel that, something is wrong with you. But we didn't feel it enough to change it. There are going to be some more Mr. Garners and more Trayvon Martins and more Michael Browns and all these people. And it's a sad time in America, a very sad time, until we start caring about each other and loving each other and reaching out with everything within us, saying, hey, I'll be a part. Doesn't matter if you're black or white, red or yellow, whatever your nationality may be, stand up, let your voice be heard. enough is enough. A nice-looking young man going to college to get his education, and you ask him, why was his zip code changed? He said, my parents recently moved. I mean, they're beating our people for nothing. What are we going to do? Where's the leadership? Those people that was on the bridge back in the day, where are they? They're not all dead. Where are they? What are they doing? I think they're downright scared. I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to die. I don't want to be another Martin Luther King. I'd like to call his name and say I walked with him and talked to him and all those things. But I don't want to die like he died. But until we're willing to die for the cause, it'll never stop. And I hope that Just Cause Organization will make it a point to get the message out that somewhere, somehow, Black America count for something in this country. There's a lot been done by this race of people. We need to start treating them like they have some value. We don't kill what's valuable. We don't destroy what's valuable. What they're sending the message to you is that really we could do without you. People rise up to the up for the cause and make up in your mind we're going to make a difference. And we got to change it. We got to raise our voices. We got to speak loud. Because if you don't speak loud, nothing will happen. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Sobering words.
Yep. It reminds you of another thing that Martin Luther King said, that he said the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy.
Well,
that's what we're seeing in the so-called civil rights leaders today. Where do you stand when you when you're watching our young people, you're watching fathers, mothers be beaten, killed, brutalized by law enforcement for no reason? And then when it, I mean, to have it on videotape and for them still to come back and say, well, you know, they didn't do anything wrong. It's like you said, it's a very sobering words, and it speaks to the condition of the country. And like the truth said, you know, we got to always stand up and be willing to fight the good fight.
And I think the difference with Martin Luther King, as she alluded to, he had a heart. I remember, if you ever watch any of Martin Luther King's speeches, there was something about when he spoke about, I know everybody's familiar with the I Have a Dream speech, excuse me, but he spoke with such conviction that he wanted something better.
Right.
And it was the cry of his heart. I think what, you know, alluding to the caller, what she just stated, this is a heart's cry. America's heart has to cry for justice. Else justice will never come. And I think to all our listeners out there and to everybody here, these are sobering words. Those are not just words that are just, you know, going out and falling. These are sobering words that make you really think, you know, and as she alluded to the fact, who's going to die today?
That's right.
That's reality. You know what I mean? And ever since, and Sam, I mean, I'm sure you've seen it, ever since Trayvon Martin, it's like a cycle of events back to back to back ever since that time, and let alone the ones that we don't hear about.
Well, it's like, you know, a time warp, and someone has set the clocks to go in reverse. And just like the truth was talking about, you know, it's there are so many things that are occurring right now that point to the fact that the things that people like Dr. Martin Luther King died for, the things that, you know, Bloody Sunday on the bridge in Selma, Alabama, all of those occurrences, it's, you know, these people get beat for nothing. And you know, like the caller earlier had said, and also Miss or when Miss Kreisberg was talking, and she was talking about, you know, people even at that time were afraid. She talked about her own parents being afraid to get involved. the truth is just talking about, you know, people being afraid to get involved. Yet it's kind of weird. You know, you look at 50 years ago, marches were going on. People were losing their life. People were losing their losing their health. I mean, they were getting beat in the streets. And now you have a generation that came after them, which were not that many years afterwards, who have benefited from that, and they sit now as millionaires, yet they are not taking their millions to do anything or step to the forefront like she was mentioning Oprah Winfrey. And you look, and then you look at situations like this one article that was on thinkprogress.org, and it says, you know, 50 years after Selma, African-Americans in Alabama are saying, we're not going back. And it's talking about, this article came out, and it was written by Alice Olstein. It came out on March 9th of this year. And it's reflecting on a lawsuit that Dr. Earl Cunningham, along with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, when they filed the lawsuit with the Supreme Court with regard to the Voting Rights Act, and how in Alabama, in Selma County or Shelby County, Alabama, how Dr. Cunningham tried to first register to vote in 1953. That's when you had the poll tax. He first had to have $1.50. Then he was asked to answer a whole bunch of questions. And then he had to state certain things about the Constitution. And then he was told to go down the street and buy his own pencil to vote with. And then when he came back, they said, okay, you can vote, but you have to sign your name if you know how to. Now, in this article, in 2013, Dr. Cunningham is sitting on the front row of the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is where he sees the injustice unfolding before his eyes. And he says that the majority of the justices decided to gut the law that put an end to the restrictive practices. And that was, as the truth was talking about, with President Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Now, with one short act, they undo that and lines voting, you know, districts, the lines get redrawn, and specifically in a situation in Calera, Alabama. I guess I'm saying that right. I might not be, but it may be Solera, Alabama. There was only one city council member who was a person of color. In 2008, that city redrew its voting maps, and his district went from being nearly 70% black to less than 30%. He lost his seat. Now, they did file a lawsuit under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act back then, and the federal government them to redraw those lines where he was able to win his seat back. But then in 2013, you go and undo the whole Civil Rights Voting Rights Act, and now states and cities have to basically police themselves. And like the truth was saying, you have young black men getting shot down in the streets. You have young black men getting choked. I don't know if you guys saw any of the footage of the young guy in, I believe his name is Morris Johnson. I'll just say Mr. Johnson, the young black man at the University of Virginia.
Yeah.
And when they had him on the ground, his head is bleeding, and they had their knees in his back and forcing him to the ground, trying to put cuffs on him. It was reminiscent of Eric Garner. Yeah. No. And so it's the same thing. And I saw on, I believe it was on Twitter, someone posted a picture. It was a photo from 1963 with a white officer choking a young black man. Next to it, they had the photo of the young man at the University of Virginia. Two white officers with their knees in his back and him down on the ground, bleeding from the head, and putting handcuffs on it. And the caption there was, is this 1963 or is it 2015? Go ahead, Lamont.
Yeah, and the bizarre part about that, as I was listening, I'm reflecting on what the caller stated. And she made the statement, hey, you know what? I remember when Oprah Winfrey, not too long ago, was voted one of the most influential women of our time. Now, you know, you were voted that way. Everybody was talking about Oprah and her Oprah. And you're telling me you're waiting on leadership when you've been pivoted in a position where people listen to what you have to say. And you know what I'm wondering, Sam and Cliff, honestly? Where's Hollywood at?
Well, the thing is...
Well, that's the thing. They're all... Right. I'm sorry, Cliff.
No, I was going to say probably the same thing you were, Sam. They're concerned about their next dollar bill on the table. Now, they have... Yeah. They have the platform.
Absolutely.
They have the microphone. And for Oprah Winfrey to say, I'm waiting for the leader.
It's a cop out.
You got to step up to the plate. That's... You look at yourself. You have the influence. Become the leader. And that, another thing Brother Martin Luther King said, he said, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends.
Absolutely.
What do you have to say, Oprah? What do you have to say, Tyler Perry? What do you guys have to say about these things that are going on? Because in the end, the young generation is not going to remember the name of the officer that killed Michael Brown or Eric Gardner or Michael Brown, or they're not going to remember that Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin. What they're going to remember is that you were silent when it happened. That's what the young generation is.
And that's what speaks volumes, your silence.
Right.
Well, and the thing is, you know, I have to think back to the times that I was in elementary school and junior high and high school and so forth. Now, I was in first grade in 1965. And
you're old.
Yeah. Thanks, Cliff. Hey, but, you know, I have to think, you know, about even during those years and growing up in Atlanta, growing up right there in the middle of where everything is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Had I not been taken to meetings and taken to, you know, different rallies and that type of thing, I certainly wouldn't have gotten it in the school that I went to.
Right.
They did not talk about it in the schools. So you have Bloody Sunday occur in 1965, and I don't recall ever hearing about any of that. I don't recall hearing about any of those kind of things growing up in elementary school. Now, so it makes you wonder, like you said, will they remember Trayvon Martin? Will they remember Eric Garner? Will they remember Michael Brown a few years from now? You know, when we were just talking to Ms. Kreisberg, and I asked a question about the political climate, the economic climate there in Selma, and she agreed. Sadly, it's no better than it was 50 years ago. So you have 70,000 people show up to the city to celebrate a situation that, certainly, yes, it did create some change in the nation. But then those 70,000 people leave, and you still got gunfire. You got violence going on there. You got, record unemployment. You got record poverty. You still have segregation. What are those 70,000 people going to do? You know, you still have a city that has not changed.
Exactly.
And now you have a nation that people are determined to press the rewind button and take us back to those kind of situations. That's not going to happen. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Profile of the Wrongful Convicted coming up. At the inception of a Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The Profile of a Wrongly Convicted.
Shortly before 10 a.m. on September 4, 2002, an 18-year-old woman was attacked and sexually assaulted as she walked to the bus station in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The woman managed to escape and ran to a house under construction. A construction worker saw her attacker fleeing, though he could not see the man's face. The woman worked with a police sketch artist and created a composite sketch that was printed in a local newspaper. About 3 weeks later, a retired police officer in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, called Elizabeth police and said he believed the sketch resembled Anthony Shapiro, whom the officer had previously arrested for a sexual assault in 1985. On September 30, 2002, Shapiro was charged with first-degree aggravated sexual assault and second-degree robbery. He went on trial in Union County Superior Court in August 2003. The victim testified to the assault, robbery, and identified Shapiro as her attacker, despite the inconsistencies between her description of the assaulter and Shapiro. On August 7th, a jury convicted Shapiro, and he was sentenced to life in prison with no eligibility for parole for 25 years. On March 2013, 10 years later, the Appellate Division of the New Jersey Superior Court reversed that decision and ordered that a hearing be held. In March 2014, following an evidentiary hearing, Shapiro's motion for a new trial was granted. His convictions were vacated, and in October 2014, Shapiro was released on bond. In anticipation of the retrial, the prosecution requested that DNA tests be performed on the victim's clothing and the swabs. The test disclosed that the DNA of an unidentified person and excluded Shapiro. On November 17, 2014, a judge granted a motion to dismiss those charges. This has been a Profile of the Wrongfully Convicted with AJC Radio.
You are listening to AJC Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. You know, when you think about the, I'll call it the systemic, well, I guess you have to just look at it the way they talk now in the terms of the new Jim Crow laws and the systemic putting away of all the black men, you know, and the process in which they're doing it. You know, you have to look at the IRP 6 case as an example. You have six gentlemen, five of which are African American and one white, who were doing something beneficial for this nation. And because a white woman got upset because the company was in debt and couldn't pay her immediately on her demand, she begins to put wheels in motion to destroy their lives. And then it just goes on and on from there. So you end up having these gentlemen who have now been wrongfully incarcerated for almost 3 years. They've been snatched away from their families. And, you know, the argument that would come up if any of these men, if their children were to go out and start committing crimes, the argument will be, well, there's no male figure in the home. Came and snatched them out of my home when I was doing something, when they were doing something beneficial. You're talking men who were respectable, men who were volunteers in their community, men who were mentors to other young, not just people of color. I mean, they were mentors to all ethnic groups. And when you take them and snatch them away and, you know, all the other stuff like we were talking about, even when it goes back to the situation in Alabama, and it's not just indicative of Alabama as far as the disenfranchising the voters. There's a systemic process underway to try and, like I said, reverse time. And you look at the hanging that just happened in Mississippi, and everyone is, you know, tipping around that and saying, you know, we don't want to speculate anything, and we don't want to pull the trigger on what happened there too prematurely. You're talking about Mississippi, and you're talking about, you know, a good ways off the road back in the woods. You know, someone twisted, obviously was involved in it, but, you know, if you almost immediately go there. I mean, if being raised the way I was raised and seeing certain things that I saw, I'm going to immediately go to the fact that something sinister happened, and you know, they're speculating that, well, this gentleman, he had served time for murder, and maybe it was someone getting revenge on that murder. Well, regardless of whether they were getting revenge on that murder or not, just that the way that he was murdered by hanging in a tree, who has a reputation for doing that in this country?
Well, Sam, to your point, I think one good point is, you know, let's just play the card. You know,
I was getting there.
I'm an African American. I lived in the South. I have seen oppression. I have seen and heard the stories about lynching black people in the woods. So guess what? My thought today is, if I take my life, I'm going to actually go to the woods. Why would I go in the woods where people were hung and lynched as a point or a way to take my life? Does that make any sense at all?
Not at all.
Well, absolutely not.
Just like I said earlier, now you're not going to go, as a black man, you're not going to go in the backwoods and hang yourself. I mean, if you're going to commit suicide, which is always, I mean, on that point, that's always what they try to say when they find a black man hanging. He must have committed suicide. That's what they said about the other young boy who was found, his new Jordans taken. Some kind of way he hung himself on a swing set, what they said would have physically been impossible for him to get up there and hang himself with a belt. That the woman at the trailer park, she found him and claimed she gets him down by herself off of a 8-foot-high swing set. He's over 200 pounds. She asked the 911 operator, well, I'm going to take him down, okay? Well, if you can get him, go ahead. She claimed she took him down by himself after he killed himself.
And now, actually got rid of his tennis shoes prior to taking his life.
It's always, well, if it's a black man, he must have committed suicide out in the woods. You know, nobody knows how he got there in the middle of the night. When you see foul play, why isn't the first assessment, this must be foul play? No, the first thing they bring out in the news, it's termed as a suicide until a further investigation.
Yeah.
You find a white person dead. This is a homicide.
Yeah.
And we will, upon further investigation, let you know if there's anything different.
I mean,
it is so sickening. What it shows you is that we still have the mindset of slavery, that the black man's life is worth nothing unless he's in a slave position, in this case, in the prison industrial complex. And if he's not in a slave position, then we can lynch him when we feel like it, and we understand that there's no retribution as far as the law goes to that. And what does America feel like the young black man is supposed to do about what America sees him as?
Well, the problem to me is that we are so easy or so quick to give the benefit of the doubt to white America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something happened, this happened. It's always a rush to believe the worst when it comes to black people.
A black man found dead, the first report, black man found dead, he had previously spent time in prison for jaywalking, theft, receiving stolen goods. they immediately put anything negative they can find about it.
It just doesn't make sense. It's as insane. Cliff, it's as insane. The insanity goes, and this may sound whatever. You know, sheriff down in Mississippi says this man, the black man, was so depressed he shot himself in the back 6 times before he died.
And how is that even believable? That is the report,
but that's the insanity,
right? But that's a report that they wrote up and expected and just knew.
Yeah,
they knew that is what would be accepted. Yeah. He was depressed. He shot himself 6 times in the back. That's the report. That's how we found him. And America's going to accept that. Why? Because of the young black man.
But that's the insanity.
That's the insanity.
That's the same insanity that you're dealing with right now.
Yes.
And it may sound comical, but the bottom line is that type of culture.
Right. I mean, that happened.
That happened.
They said the boy was so depressed. And then the other one. He was handcuffed in the back seat, but he was so upset about getting arrested that he shot himself in the back of the head.
Handcuffed.
He's handcuffed in the back seat.
Right.
Where'd he get a gun from? Well, after we frisked him, he must have had it.
Are you serious right
it
now?
Must have been in – wait a minute. This is the only way. He had it in some orifice or cavity of his body, and then he passed it in the back seat, handcuffed, got his pants down, got the gun, and shot himself in the back
of the head. I mean, there's an easier way to go.
There's an easier way to go. How about I'm not going to kill myself?
Right.
How do you kill yourself in the backseat of a car handcuffed?
And this, you know, it goes to, and this is so very, very true. What the caller said, no leadership, everything has gone awry.
Yes.
It's just, are you honestly kidding me right now? That is actually an explanation you gave, and guess what? They bought it.
It was accepted.
How do you accept nonsense on that level?
Yes.
It's uncomprehendable to me.
Now, and you know what really adds an interesting twist to this is that Claiborne County, Mississippi, is predominantly black. So, you know, for this type of thing to happen there, and let's just go to, like you were saying, Lamont, it is what it looks like. Let's say that that is the situation, that someone, whether they were wearing a white sheet or not, but a white person went in and for whatever reason didn't like what this gentleman had done, or he had a beef with somebody. Let's just, you know, let's put it that way. Why are you in? That takes a lot of boldness to come into a county that's 80-something% African-American. And that's like saying, you know, I don't care what you are. Now, you know, as far as income levels and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's really, really low. So, you know, you're not talking wealthy people by any stretch of the imagination. But the fact that, you know, you look at the police force, you look at different the makeup of the population there, it doesn't even add up, which even makes this story. I mean, I can't wait to see what the FBI and what the Civil Rights Division and what the Mississippi Bureau of Investigations, what they come back with. I mean, if we're wrong, like you said, Clev, you know, we will admit that, okay, we didn't read that one right.
Right. The thing is, what you have to look at, you know, you deal with the fact that you know, this is a predominantly black area with, you know, a few white people in the police force. But what does that remind you of? That's a plantation. We have 4,000 slaves on this plantation, and we got Massa and his 4 kids. And they, through brutality, through weaponry, through injustice, and through everything that they can, they oppress the people that they're over. I mean, it is the same mentality, and they've held it that way since the civil rights time, since before Selma. They've had the black community there in fear of, if you do something, we will kill you. You're not going to jail. We're going to lynch you. We're going to give you 6 warning shots in the back of the head, or we will just dig a hole and bury you in it alive. And that is the mentality. That is what has started there, and that is what has been maintained. That's why law enforcement in these different type of communities and areas can get away with these type of things. Now, they can't pull that much in L.A. They can't pull that much in New York. Right. they get a riot because people say, I haven't been living under this type of impression. I will not accept it readily.
Right. And I think the target, you know, Ferguson, what percentage of African-American was Ferguson? I think we talked about it a week or so ago.
Yeah, Ferguson.
It's predominantly black.
Yeah. I think, you know, the predominant of black sometimes ignites when racism is alive and well. The more blacks that are in an area, the more ignited they become.
Right.
So it does, you know, at least where racism is. And in this particular case, that, you know, somebody, you know, and again, I'm speculating here, but if it sounds like a I forget the words they use.
It quacks like a duck.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I don't see an African American going in the middle of the woods in Mississippi.
You know what's out there. Right? You know the danger of I go out in the middle of the woods. What'll probably happen to me? I'll probably end up lynched.
Mississippi is known for lynching.
They're known for lynching. And they will not only if you go in the woods and stray, you get found on the side of the road. You might, just walking and you might end up getting lynched. You get found outside of your house and you might get lynched.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones, Cliff.
All righty. We have the Truth. You have another comment. You're live.
Yes, I'd like to make one more comment if I can. I was thinking today, I don't know if you heard on the news about the new congressman that hadn't been long got to Washington during this Congress. And he was as wild as he could be. I mean, he was living, spending money he shouldn't have spent, taxpayers' money, and
right.
Taking trips and $500 shoes, $5,000 suits, and all this stuff. And some of them said on the news today that he'll never last because you know he's just so so out of control, and you can't come there and just start doing all this crazy stuff and taking pictures of it and all this. And you know what they said about him? They said, well, he's young. Maybe he'll learn from it. Because he resigned.
Yeah. Right.
He gave the little money back, whatever it was, from what I can remember, and said, well, he'll learn. He's young. I thought, well, did you not feel that way about Jesse Jackson's son? He's young.
Yeah, he's young.
He'll learn. Now, they put him in jail for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, that's amazing. I mean, the double standard is what's causing a lot of the anger.
Right.
It's like he can come to Congress and do all that. But I think they were afraid that Jesse Jackson's son that they put in prison had the possibility of becoming president or whatever. And if we got any black and brown anywhere that looked like there may be a remote possibility, we're going to finish him. And put him in prison, as soon as he come out, his wife is going to prison. And he spent money he shouldn't have spent. That was taxpayers' money and what have you. But nobody ever said, well, he's young. He'll learn. If you just give us the same treatment, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Same treatment. The double standard is killing people. Because, you know, if you're white, you're right. If you're black, you just should get back in a corner somewhere. And if we can find a tree, let's hang you on it. Because we just don't like you because you're black. It's so sad, so sad. I kept watching that today. I thought, now when y'all got through painting the picture for this newly elected congressman, he's young. He's gonna be old. He'll be okay. He'll grow out of it. But Jesse Jackson's son sitting in prison. Something's wrong with that picture. Very badly wrong with that picture. And I think as long as we have a double standard in this country when it comes to right and wrong, just plain justice, as long as we have it, we're going to have people angry, fighting back, wanting to defend their rights and pointing to the next fellow. Well, why did you give him this and give this to me? Well, even in families, we'd have a problem with it. Oh, we really got to do a lot of praying and a lot of standing up and making our voices heard, because this kind of stuff is nothing like the justice of God, because it's fair with everybody. But when it comes to this world, there's no such thing as fairness. It all depends on whether or not I want you to go to prison. If you're poor, you're black, you're Hispanic, you're Mexican, whatever, 9 times out of 10, you're going to prison. And I'm going to double your time, get you off the street. The white boy, he gets it done. Sometimes he don't even get a sentence. He gets probation.
Mm-hmm.
And a little community service. It's bad. We've got to keep pushing for that. That we get justice for everybody. Because no matter where injustice is, if it's in one little corner of the earth, it's everywhere. Because that's how powerful it is. Thank you.
And to her point, Sam, I remember a gentleman in county jail doing my wrongful incarceration.
Had 9 felonies. Went before the judge. Everybody, he comes back to the pod and says, "We're thinking, man, just too bad." People were saying, "Man, they're preparing him for prison." He says the judge gave me probation with 9 felonies.
Wow. How does that even begin to abide by the 3 strikes?
And I can guarantee you can guess what color he was.
Was he black?
It goes to the caller's point. It is what it is. And people better just wake up to that. It is what it is.
Well, and you know, you look at the injustice, and I happened to catch what caught my eye, I think it was yesterday or day before, on Dr. Phil. He had a guy who was, he's like the Grand Wizard or whatever they call him,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the KKK, skinhead and all that other stuff, down in, and I believe it's in Mississippi where he's at. And he got convicted to 12 years for illegal weapons possession, illegally making explosives, and then having all of the components to make explosives. He got sentenced to 12 years. He did 9 years, and he comes out, and he's still talking the hate crime stuff. Now, this, you know, I thought we had laws against that. He's still talking the hate crime stuff, and he had the audacity to say that he hates blacks and Jews because, well, with blacks, he said that he doesn't want his children to associate with them because they're just up to no good and they're bound for prison. Dr. Phil flipped it on him and said, "Wait a minute, you just did 9 years in prison for illegal weapons possession and crimes against the United States, so to speak." And so but it goes back to the, like you said, Lamont, the culture. It's the brainwashing where, okay, this is a white gentleman, and if he's talking to other white people and he spews that type of nonsense and that's that type of poison, when they see another black man, it could be a black professional. It could be a doctor, an attorney, a computer professional, or whatever. It could be someone in law enforcement. They're going to disrespect that person because they've been brainwashed to think that just because of the color of your skin, you are inferior and that you're violent. Yet, this is a violent man that's saying all this stuff.
And what's bizarre, Sam, if the racist is listening to the program tonight,
and they are,
a man has no control when he comes into this world what color he is. How can you hate a man because of his color?
That's right.
That is the most ludicrous, because he's a little darker than I am, or you hate me?
But you look at this man that Sam's talking about that was on Dr. Phil's show. Now, you went to prison. You still do not release the stereotype that black men are just bound for prison. The mindset, it is ingrained in the mindset that, just be prejudiced because that's just how you live your life. It is totally crazy. And this is what he's telling people. This is what he's telling his children. It's like, this man needs to fall off the face of the earth. It's like, you are, what are you talking about? You were a prisoner.
You know what?
You were the criminal. But, hey, black men, they are criminals.
You know the tragedy? I saw a picture on Facebook that showed a white baby and a black baby, and they were hugged up asleep in diapers.
Right.
And under the caption, it says, racism is taught.
It's a taught behavior.
You're not born with that.
That's right.
When I was a little kid, I wanted to go out and make friends in the neighborhood. I didn't care what color you were, man. Let's
absolutely
go play in
the sandbox.
As long
as you had a piece of candy.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's and you know what? The people responsible, it is a culture. And I saw something on a bumper sticker there that said, mean big people create mean little people.
That's true.
And that's so very, very true. It is a taught behavior. No one is born racist. You have to teach that baby, look at that. He's no good. Don't play with him. That is a taught behavior. And you understand what I'm saying? That is something that is insanity. Adults are responsible for that.
Yes.
You're teaching your kids to hate. That had to come from somewhere. It didn't come from those innocent little kids.
And just like you have a dog and a cat, when they're a puppy and a kitten,
they
get along,
different.
They can play. It's like, I don't hate you because you're a cat. A person teaches a dog to hate a cat by telling him to attack him when he sees it.
Absolutely.
That's the same thing with humans.
And how do we bring that to the human race?
Right. How do you bring to the human race that, hey, there's a black kid. Go over there, attack him. 10 of y'all. Go attack him. Stomp him out.
It's uncomprehensible.
It's tall.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a really quick short break, and then we're going to come back and close things out. This is Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back.
We have no alternative but to keep moving with determination. We've gone too far now to turn back. And in a real sense, we are moving, and we cannot afford to stop, because Alabama and because our nation has a date with destiny.
I'm here to tell you tonight that the businessmen, the mayor of this city, the police commissioner of this city, and everybody in the white power structure of this city must take a responsibility for everything that Jim Clark does in this community. It's time for us to say to these men that if you don't do something about it, we will have no alternative but to engage in broader and more drastic forms of civil disobedience in order to bring the attention of the nation to this whole issue in Selma, Alabama.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. And that was a clip from Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago in Selma. And, you know, two things that stand out when you think about that. He says that Alabama and the nation have a date with destiny. And then, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot, and he brought it up also, or he stated it in his speech, that all of the people that are in position of power must take responsibility for everything that happens as a result of Jim Crow. So, I mean, you can look at the things that are going on now, and the same issue is on the table with regard to accountability. And, you know, Cliff, like you often say, with the IRP 6 and with other judicial matters that we're pushing for, we have written letters, we have made phone calls, we've made visits to Capitol Hill. You go to everyone and no one, or until recently, I mean, there are some folks who are really getting on board, but it took the longest to find someone that would be accountable for their actions. When you get a letter back from the Department of Justice and no one signs it, no one puts their name on it, that's, I mean, if that's not a clear indication that I don't want to be responsible for this, I don't know what is. I mean, and these are people of color that are in these positions.
Yeah.
And well, I said it before, you had people dying. You had people shedding their blood for this type of thing. And you get to these positions, and you do nothing with it.
It's like basically what they're saying is, you know what, just let it go. Here's a letter with no signature. We're not going to do anything. Just let it go. And just like the truth said, we cannot let it go. We have to continue to stand up and fight, because if we don't, the whole situation will get worse. With the fight that has been happening, it's been stabilized from the 60s.
Right.
With as much fight that has been going on. So if we don't continue to fight and fight harder, then it'll go backwards, because in 50 years, it's still exactly the same. Imagine if no one was fighting.
Cliff, it's not going to go backwards. This country is going to implode.
Yes.
And you know what?
Before that happens. I mean, because, and that's I think, illustrated by some of the things that's going on. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I thought what stood out to me on that clip with Dr. King, there was absolutely no fear on any level. And that's where we have to be.
This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thank you for joining us for another great broadcast. Join us each Tuesday and Thursday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time for more of bringing to light a lot of the things that are going on in this nation with regard to injustice, but then also having some excellent dialogue about how to fix it. We also ask that you keep our brothers in prayer, the IRP6. That's David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And these families, or the families of these men, are greatly impacted by this wrongful imprisonment. And you need to go out to the website where we have information out there about their case. It's freetheirp6.org. You can read all about their case, the injustice that went down in that case, and the things that we're doing to bring about an exoneration there. But, Lisa, in the meantime, we're asking our listeners to reach out, help their families.
Yes, we're asking everyone to go out to GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. Do a search on IRP6, and you'll find some information about the families, and there will also be a link where you can donate to those families.
And one quick point, about the, giving money, if you can, to help these families.
Yeah.
The gentleman that shot Trayvon Martin, his name again, Zimmerman, raised almost $500,000 by people that said, we'd like to help out. Let's do something that's right. These men are wrongfully convicted. We're saying help their families. If you can help a man that shot a man in cold blood and people get behind them and give them money, can we not do it for the folks that have been suffering a huge injustice as a result of this system?
Right.
Cliff.
Well said, Lamont. I want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room, all of our callers. Also to our guest, Cheyenne Webb Kreisberg. Thank you for taking time out of your evening tonight to spend with us. It is very much appreciated. To our production team, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D, help those skills girls to ensure that you hear what it is that we have to say. Also, to our production support team, they're giving us accurate and up-to-date information so we can pass that on to you. To the truth, we heard from you tonight. We appreciate it.
Also, want to say thank you to Barbara and Miss Barbara and Olivia for all your hard work you're doing behind the scenes. We appreciate everything you do.
For archives of our weekly broadcast, go to ajcradio.com and also go to i365.com for 24/7 programming. Each Sunday morning from 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. And then also for on-demand programming, you can go to the 405 Radio or iTunes. Also, A Just Cause is a 501c3. Go to www.a-justcause to see how you might be able to donate. Thanks again for joining us. On behalf of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks, I'm Sam Thurman. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.
Deep down in our nonviolent creed is the conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious,
something so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man happens to be 36 years old, as I happen to be, and some great truth stands before the door of his life, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is right, he's afraid his home will get bombed, or he's afraid that he will lose his job, or he's afraid that he will get shot or beat down by state troopers. He may go on and live until he's 80. Yes. But he's just as dead at 36 as he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the belated announcement of an earlier death of the spirit. He died. Dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right.
Yes. Yes.
A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice.
Yes.
A man dies when he refuses to take a stand for that which is true.
Yes.
So we're going to stand up right here amid horses.
Yes.
We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid the billy club. We're going to stand up right here in Alabama amid police dogs, if they have them. We're going to stand up amid tear gas.
Yes.
We're going to stand up amid anything that they can muster up.
Yes.
Letting the world know
Yes.
that we are determined to be free.